Gordon stared at Jeffrey with what Jeffrey assumed the young punk thought was a menacing look. I told you everything.
No, Jeffrey said, you didn't. You're leaving something out that's pretty important, and I swear to God you're not going to leave this room until you tell me what you know.
Gordon turned shifty-eyed.
I don't know anything.
Buddy leaned over and whispered something that made Gordon's eyes go as round as two walnuts. Whatever the attorney had said to his client, it worked. Gordon said,
I followed her out of the library.
Yeah? Jeffrey encouraged.
She met up with this guy, okay?
Gordon fiddled with his hands in front of him. Jeffrey wanted to reach over and throttle the punk.
I tried to catch up with them, but they were fast.
Fast meaning how? Jeffrey asked. Was she walking with him?
No,
Gordon said.
He was carrying her.
Jeffrey felt a knot in the pit of his stomach.
And you didn't think this was suspicious, her being carried off by a guy?
Gordon's shoulders went up to his ears.
I was mad, okay? I was mad at her.
You knew she wouldn't meet you later on, Jeffrey began. So you followed her.
He gave a slight shrug that could have been a yes or no.
And you saw this guy carrying her off, Jeffrey continued.
Yeah.
Frank asked, what did he look like?
Tall, I guess, Gordon said. I couldn't see his face, if that's what you mean.
White? Black? Jeffrey quizzed.
Yeah, white, Gordon supplied. White and tall. He was wearing dark clothes, all black. I couldn't really see them except that she was wearing this white shirt, right? It kind of caught the light, so she showed up, but not him.
Frank said, did you follow them?
Gordon shook his head. Frank was silent, his jaw taut with anger.
You know she's dead now, don't you?
Gordon looked down at the table.
Yeah, I know that.
Jeffrey opened the file and showed Gordon the printout. He had used a black marker to cross out Wright's name, but the rest of the statistics were left uncovered.
This the guy?
Gordon glanced down.
No.
Look at the fucking photograph,
Jeffrey ordered, his tone so loud that Frank started beside him. Gordon did as he was told, putting his face so close to the printout that his nose almost touched it.
I don't know, man, he said. It was dark. I couldn't see his face.
His eyes scanned down the vitals on Wright.
He was tall like this, about this build. It could have been him, I guess.
He gave a casual shrug.
I mean, Jesus, I wasn't paying attention to him. I was watching her.
The drive to Atlanta was long and tedious, with nothing but the occasional patch of trees with the requisite kudzu to break the monotony. He tried twice to call Sarah at home and leave some kind of message, but her machine wouldn't pick up, even after 20 rings. Jeffrey felt a rush of relief followed by an overwhelming shame. The closer he got to the city, the more he convinced himself that he was doing the right thing. He could call Sarah when he knew something. Maybe he could call her with the news that Jack Allen Wright had met with an unfortunate accident involving Jeffrey's gun and Wright's chest. Even going 80, it took Jeffrey 4 hours before he got off 20 and onto the downtown connector. He passed Grady Hospital a little ways past the split and felt tears wanting to come again. The building was a monster looming over the interstate in what Atlanta traffic reporters called the Grady Curve. Grady was one of the largest hospitals in the world. Sarah had told him that during any given year, the emergency clinic saw over 200,000 patients. A recent $400 million renovation made the hospital look like part of the set for a Batman movie. In typical City of Atlanta politics, the renovation had been the subject of an explosive investigation, kickbacks and payoffs reaching as far up as City Hall. Jeffrey took the downtown exit, then drove by the Capitol. His friend on the Atlanta force had been shot on the job and taken a guard's position at the courthouse rather than early retirement. A call back in Grant had scheduled a meeting for 4 o'clock.
It was quarter till by the time Jeffrey found a parking space in the crowded Capitol section of downtown. Keith Ross was waiting outside the courts building when Jeffrey walked up. In one hand, he held a large file folder, in the other, a plain white mailing envelope.
"Ain't seen you in a coon's age," Keith said, giving Jeffrey's hand a firm handshake.
"Good to see you too, Keith," Jeffrey returned, trying to force a lightness into his voice that he did not feel. The ride up to Atlanta had done nothing but get Jeffrey more wound up. Even the brisk walk from the parking garage to the courts building had not alleviated his tension.
"I can only let you have these for a second," Keith said,
obviously sensing Jeffrey's need to move this along.
"I got it from a buddy of mine over at Records."
Jeffrey took the folder, but he did not open it. He knew what he would find inside. Pictures of Sarah, witness testimony, detailed descriptions of exactly what had happened in that bathroom.
"Let's go inside," Keith said, ushering Jeffrey into the building.
Jeffrey flashed his badge at the door, bypassing the security check. Keith led him into a small office to the side of the entrance. A desk surrounded by television monitors filled the room. A kid wearing thick glasses and a police uniform looked up with surprise as they entered. Keith took a $20 bill out of his pocket.
"Go buy yourself some candy," he said.
The kid took the money and left without another word.
"Devotion to the job," Keith commented wryly. "You gotta wonder what they're doing on the force."
"Yeah,"
Jeffrey mumbled, not wanting to have a protracted conversation about the quality of police recruits.
"I'll leave you to it," Keith said. 10 minutes, okay?"
"Okay," Jeffrey answered, waiting for the door to close. The file was coded and dated with some obscure notations that only a city employee could figure out. Jeffrey rubbed his hand down the front of the folder, as if he could absorb the information without actually having to see it. When that did not work, he took a deep breath and opened the folder. Pictures of Sarah after the rape greeted him. Close-ups of her hands and feet, the stab wound in her side, and her battered female parts spilled out onto the desk in full color. He actually gasped at the sight of them. His chest felt tight, and a stabbing pain ran down his arm. Jeffrey thought for just a second that he was having a heart attack. But a few deep breaths helped clear his mind. He realized that his eyes were closed, and he opened them, not looking at the pictures of Sarah as he turned them face down. Jeffrey loosened his tie, trying to push the images from his mind. He thumbed through the other photographs, finding a picture of Sarah's car. It was a silver BMW 320 with black bumpers and a blue stripe down the sides. Carved into the door, probably with a key, was the word "cunt," just as Sarah had said in her trial testimony. Pictures showed a before and after of the door, with and without the silver duct tape. Jeffrey got a flash of Sarah kneeling in front of the door, taping over the damage, probably thinking in her mind that she would get her Uncle Al to repair the damage when she was back in Grant next. Jeffrey checked his watch, noting 5 minutes had passed. He found Keith in one of the security cameras, his hands tucked into his pockets, as he shot the shit with the guards at the door. Thumbing through the back of the file, he found the arrest report on Jack Allen Wright. Wright had been arrested twice before on suspicion, but never charged. In the first incident, a young woman about the age Sarah had been when she was attacked had dropped the charges and moved out of town. In the other case, the young woman had taken her own life. Jeffrey rubbed his eyes, thinking about Julia Matthews. A knock came at the door. Then Keith said,
"I gotta call time, Jeffrey."
"Yeah," Jeffrey said, closing the file. He didn't want to hold it in his hands anymore. He held it out to Keith without looking at the other man.
"This help you any?"
Jeffrey gave a nod, straightening his tie.
"Some," he said. "Were you able to find out where this guy is?"
"Just down the street," Keith answered. "Working at the bank building."
"That's what, 10 minutes from the university? Another 5 from Grady?"
"You got it."
"What's he do?"
"He's a janitor, like he was at Grady."
Keith said. He had obviously looked at the file before giving it to Jeffrey. All those college girls, and he's 10 minutes from them. Do the campus police know? They do now, Keith provided, giving Jeffrey a knowing look. Not that he's much of a threat anymore. What does that mean? Jeffrey asked. Part of his parole, Keith said, indicating the file. You didn't get to that? He's taking depo. Jeffrey felt an uneasiness spread over him like warm water. Depo Provera was the latest trend in treating sexual offenders. Normally used in women as part of a hormone replacement therapy, a high enough dosage could curb a man's sexual appetite. When the drug was used on sexual predators, it was referred to as a chemical castration. Jeffrey knew the drug only worked as long as the perpetrator took it. It was more like a tranquilizer than a cure. Jeffrey indicated the folder. He could not say Sarah's name in this room. He raped someone else after this? He raped two someone else's after this, Keith answered. There was this Linton girl. He stabbed her, right? Attempted murder, 6 years. Got early parole for good behavior. Went on the depo, went off the depo, went out and raped two more women. They caught him on one, the other girl wouldn't testify. Put him back in jail for 3 years. Now he's out on parole with the depo administered under close supervision.
He's raped 5 girls and he's only served 10 years?
They only nailed him on 2, and except for her, he indicated Sarah's file. The other IDs were pretty shaky. He wore a mask. You know how it gets with those girls on the stand. They get all nervous, and before you know it, opposing counsel has them wondering if they were even raped in the first place, let alone who did it.
Jeffrey held his tongue, but Keith seemed to read his mind.
Hey, Keith said, I'd been working those cases. The bastard would have been sent to the chair. Know what I mean?
Yeah, Jeffrey said, thinking this boasting wasn't getting them anywhere.
Is he ready for his third strike? He asked.
Georgia, like many states, had enacted a third strike law some time ago, meaning that a convict's third felony offense, no matter how innocuous, would send him or her back to jail, conceivably for the rest of his or her life.
Sounds like it, Keith answered.
Who's his P.O.?
Already took care of that one, Keith said. Writes on a bracelet. P.O. says he's clean going back the last 2 years. Also said he'd pretty much cut off his head before going back to jail.
Jeffrey nodded at this. Jack Wright was forced to wear a monitoring bracelet as a condition of his parole. If he left his designated roaming area or missed his curfew, an alarm would go off at the monitoring station. In the city of Atlanta, most parole officers were stationed at police precincts around town so they could snatch up violators on a moment's notice. It was a good system, and despite the fact that Atlanta was such a large city, not many parolees slipped through the cracks.
Also, he said, I walked on down to the bank building.
He shrugged apologetically, recognizing he had overstepped the line. This was Jeffrey's case. But Keith was probably bored out of his mind from checking purses for handguns all day.
No, Jeffrey said. That's fine. What'd you get? Got a peek at his time cards. He was punched in every morning at 7, then out to lunch at noon, back at 12:30, then out at 5.
Nobody could have punched it for him?
Keith shrugged. Supervisor didn't eyeball him, but she says there would have been complaints from the offices if he hadn't been on the job. Evidently, those professional types like to have their cans taken care of bright and early.
Jeffrey pointed to the white mailing envelope Keith held in his hand.
What's that? Registration, Keith said, handing him the envelope. He drives a blue Chevy Nova.
Jeffrey slit the envelope open with his thumb. Inside was a photocopy of Jack Allen Wright's vehicle registration. The address was under his name.
Current? Jeffrey asked. Yeah, Keith answered. Only, you understand, you didn't get it from me.
Jeffrey knew what he meant. Atlanta's chief of police ran her department by its short hairs. Jeffrey knew her reputation and admired her work.
but he also knew that if she thought some hick cop from Grant County was stepping on her toes, the next thing Jeffrey would feel would be a 3-inch stiletto parked firmly on the back of his neck.
"You get what you need from Wright," Keith said. "Then call in APD.
He handed Jeffrey a business card with Atlanta's Rising Phoenix in the center of it. Jeffrey turned it over, seeing a name and number scribbled on the back. Keith said,
"This is his P.O. She's a good gal, but she'll want something solid to explain why you just happened to be in Wright's face."
"You know her?"
"Know of her," Keith said. "Real ball breaker, so watch yourself. You call her in to snatch up her boy and she thinks you're looking at her funny, she'll make sure you never see him again."
Jeffrey said, "I'll try to be a gentleman." Keith offered,
"Ashton is just off the interstate. Let me give you directions."
Chapter 21. Nick Shelton's voice boomed across the telephone line.
"Hey, lady."
"Hey, Nick," Sarah returned, closing a chart on her desk. She had been at the clinic since 8 o'clock that morning and seen patients right up until 4 o'clock. Sarah felt as if she had been running in quicksand all day. There was a slight ache in her head, and her stomach was queasy from drinking a little too much the night before, not to mention her uneasiness over the emotional drama that had unfolded. As the day wore on, Sarah began to feel more drained. At lunch, Molly had commented that Sarah looked as if she should be the patient today instead of the doctor.
"I showed Mark those seeds," Nick said. "He says they're belladonna all right, only it's the berries, not the seeds."
"I guess that's good to know," Sarah managed. "He's certain?"
100%, Nick returned. "He says it's kind of funny they ate the berries. Remember, those are the least poisonous. Maybe your guide down there gives them the berries to keep them a little jazzed, then doesn't give them the final dose until he turns them loose."
"That makes sense," Sarah said, not even wanting to think about it. She did not want to be a doctor today. She did not want to be a coroner. She wanted to be in bed with some tea and mindless television. In fact, that was exactly what she was going to do as soon as she finished updating the last chart from today. Thankfully, Nellie had booked tomorrow for Sarah's day off. She would take the weekend to decompress. Monday, Sarah would be back to her old self. Sarah asked, "Anything on the semen sample?"
"We're having some problems with that. Considering where you found it, I think we'll be able to get something out of it, though."
"That's good news, I guess."
Nick said, "You gonna tell Jeffrey about the berries, or should I call him?"
Sarah felt her stomach drop at the mention of Jeffrey's name.
"Sarah?" Nick asked.
"Yeah," she answered. "I'll talk to him about it as soon as I get off work." Sarah hung up the phone after the appropriate goodbyes, then sat in her office, rubbing the small of her back. She reviewed the next chart at a glance, updating a change in medication as well as a follow-up visit for lab results. By the time she had finished with the last chart, it was 5:30. Sarah crammed a couple of files into her briefcase, knowing she would have some time over the weekend where guilt would set in and she would want to do some work. Dictation was something she could do at home with a small tape recorder. There was a transcription place in Macon that would type up the notes for her and have them back in a couple of days. She buttoned her jacket as she crossed the street, heading downtown. She took the sidewalk opposite the pharmacy, not wanting to run into Jeb. Sarah kept her head down, passing the hardware store and the dress shop, not wanting to invite conversation. That she stopped in front of the police station was something of a surprise. Her mind was working without her knowing, and with each step, she got more and more angry with Jeffrey for not calling. She had arguably left her soul laid out on his bathroom sink, and he had not even had the decency to call her. Sarah walked into the station house, managing a smile for Marla. "Is Jeffrey in?" Marla frowned.
"I don't think so," she said. "He checked out about noon or so. You might ask Frank."
"He's in the back?"
Sarah indicated the door with her briefcase.
"I think," Marla answered, returning to the task before her. Sarah glanced down as she passed the older woman. Marla was working on a crossword puzzle. The back room was empty, the 10 or so desks normally occupied by the senior detectives vacant for the time being. Sarah assumed they were out working down Jeffrey's list or grabbing dinner. She kept her head up, strolling into Jeffrey's office. Of course, he wasn't there.
Sarah stood in the small office, resting her briefcase on his desk. She had been in this room so many times, she couldn't begin to count them. Always, she had felt safe here. Even after the divorce, Sarah had felt that in this one area, Jeffrey was trustworthy. As a policeman, he had always done the right thing. He had done everything in his power to make sure the people he served were protected. When Sarah first moved back to Grant 12 years ago, no amount of reassurances from her father and her family could convince her that she was safe. Sarah had known that as soon as she walked into the pawn shop, news would spread that she had purchased a weapon. What's more, she knew that in order to register a gun, she would have to go to the police station. Ben Walker, the chief of police before Jeffrey, played poker with Eddie Linton every Friday night. There had been no way for Sarah to buy it without alerting everyone who knew her. Around that time, a gangbanger had come into the Augusta hospital with his arm nearly torn off by a bullet. Sarah had worked on the kid and saved his arm. He was only 14, and when his mother came in, she had started beating him on his head with her purse. Sarah had left the room, but a few moments later the mother had found her. The woman had given Sarah her son's weapon and asked Sarah to take care of it. If Sarah had been a Christian woman, she would have called the event a miracle. The gun, Sarah knew, was now in Jeffrey's desk drawer. She checked over her shoulder before sliding it open, taking out the bag with the Ruger in it. She tucked it in her briefcase and was out the door within a few minutes. Sarah kept her head up as she walked toward the college. Her boat was docked in front of the boathouse, and she tossed her briefcase in with one hand while untying the line with the other. Her parents had given her the boat as a housewarming present, and it was an old but sturdy vessel. The engine was strong, and Sarah had skied behind it many times, her father at the wheel, holding back on the throttle for fear of jerking her arms off. After checking that she was not being watched, Sarah slipped the gun out of her briefcase and locked it in the watertight glove box in front of the passenger seat, plastic bag and all. She stepped her leg outside the boat, using her foot to push away from the dock. The engine sputtered when she turned the key. Technically, she should have had the motor checked before using the boat again after not using it all winter, but she did not really have a choice, since the techs would not be finished with her car until Monday. Asking her father for a lift would have invited too much conversation, and Jeffrey was not an option. After emitting a cloud of nasty-looking blue smoke, the engine caught, and Sarah pulled away from the dock, allowing a small smile. She had felt like a criminal leaving with the gun in her briefcase, but she was feeling safer. Whatever Jeffrey thought when he saw the gun was gone was not really Sarah's concern. By the time she reached the center of the lake, the boat was skipping across the water. Cold wind cut through her face as she put her glasses on to protect her eyes. Though the sun was beating down, the water was cool from the recent rains that had fallen on Grant County. It looked ready to storm again tonight, but probably well after the sun went down. Sarah zipped her jacket closed to fight the cold. Still, by the time she could see the back of her house, her nose was running and her cheeks felt as if she had put her face into a bucket of ice-cold water. Cutting a hard left, she steered away from a group of rocks under the water. There had been a sign marking the spot at one time, but it had rotted away years ago. With the recent rains, the lake was high, but Sarah did not want to risk it. She had docked into the boathouse and was using the electric winch to pull the boat out of the water when her mother appeared from the back of the house. "Shit," Sarah mumbled, pressing the red button to stop the winch. "I called the clinic," Kathy said.
Nellie said you were taking Tamara off.
That's right, Sarah answered, pulling the chains to lower the door behind the boat.
Your sister told me about your argument last night.
Sarah jerked the chain tight, sending a clattering through the metal structure. If you're here to threaten me, the damage has been done.
Meaning?
Sarah walked past her mother, stepping off the dock. Meaning he knows, she said, tucking her hands into her hips, waiting for her mother to follow.
What did he say?
I can't talk about it, Sarah answered, turning toward the house. Her mother followed her up the lawn but was thankfully silent. Sarah unlocked the back door, leaving it open for her mother as she went into the kitchen. She realized too late that the house was a mess. Kathy said,
"Really, Sarah, you can make time to clean."
"I've been very busy at work."
"That's not an excuse," Kathy lectured. "Just say to yourself, I'm going to do one load of laundry every other day. I'm going to make sure I put things back where I found them. Pretty soon you're organized."
Sarah ignored the familiar advice as she walked into the living room. She pressed the scroll on the caller ID unit, but no calls had been logged.
"Power went off,"
her mother said, pressing the buttons on the stove to set the time.
"These storms are playing havoc with the cable. Your father almost had a heart attack last night when he turned on Jeopardy and got nothing but fuzz."
Sarah felt some relief from this. Maybe Jeffrey had called. Stranger things had happened. She walked over to the sink, filling the tea kettle with water.
"Do you want some tea?"
Kathy shook her head.
"Me either,"
Sarah mumbled, leaving the kettle in the sink. She walked to the back of the house, taking off her shirt, then her skirt, as she walked into the bedroom. Kathy followed her, keeping a trained mother's eye on her daughter.
"Are you fighting with Jeffrey again?"
Sarah slipped a T-shirt over her head.
"I'm always fighting with Jeffrey, Mother. It's what we do."
"When you're not busy squirming in your seat over him at church." Sarah bit her lip, feeling her cheeks turn red. Kathy asked,
"What happened this time?"
"God, Mama, I really don't want to talk about it."
"Then tell me about this thing with Jeb McGuire."
"There's no thing, really." Sarah slipped on a pair of sweatpants. Kathy sat on the bed, smoothing the sheet out with the flat of her hand.
"That's good. He's not really your type."
Sarah laughed.
"What's my type?"
"Someone who can stand up to you."
"Maybe I like Jeb," Sarah countered, aware there was a petulant tone to her voice.
"Maybe I like the fact that he's predictable and nice and calm. God knows he's waited long enough to go out with me. Maybe I should start seeing him."
Kathy said, "You're not as angry with Jeffrey as you think."
"Oh, really?"
"You're just hurt, and that's making you feel angry. You so seldom open yourself up to other people," Kathy continued.
Sarah noticed that her mother's voice was soothing yet firm, as if she were coaxing a dangerous animal out of its hole.
"I remember when you were little. You were always so careful about who you let be your friend."
Sarah sat on the bed so she could put on her socks. She said, "I have lots of friends."
"Oh, you were popular, but you only let a few people in."
She stroked Sarah's hair back behind her ear.
"And after what happened in Atlanta."
Sarah put her hand over her eyes. Tears came, and she mumbled,
"Mama, I really can't talk about that right now, okay? Please, not now."
"All right." Kathy relented, putting her arm around Sarah's shoulder. She pulled Sarah's head to her chest.
"Shh."
Kathy hushed, stroking Sarah's hair.
"It's okay."
"I just..." Sarah shook her head, unable to continue. She had forgotten how good it felt to be comforted by her mother. The last few days, she had been so intent upon pushing Jeffrey away that she had managed to distance herself from her family as well. Kathy pressed her lips to the crown of Sarah's head, saying,
There was an indiscretion between your father and me.
Sarah was so surprised that she stopped crying.
Daddy cheated on you?
Of course not. Kathy frowned. A few seconds passed before she provided. It was the other way around.
Sarah felt like an echo.
You cheated on Daddy?
It was never consummated, but in my heart, I felt that it was.
What does that mean?
Sarah shook her head, thinking this sounded like one of Jeffrey's excuses. Flimsy.
No, never mind. She wiped her eyes with the back of her hands, thinking she did not really want to hear this. Her parents' marriage was the pedestal upon which Sarah had placed all her ideas about relationships and love. Kathy seemed intent on telling her story.
I told your father that I wanted to leave him for another man.
Sarah felt silly with her mouth hanging open, but there wasn't much she could do about it. She finally managed.
Who?
Just a man. He was stable, had a job over at one of the plants. Very calm, very serious.
Very different from your father.
What happened?
I told your father that I wanted to leave him.
And?
He cried and I cried. We were separated for about 6 months. In the end, we decided to stay together.
Who was the other man?
It doesn't matter now.
Is he still in town?
Kathy shook her head. Doesn't matter. He's not in my life anymore, and I'm with your father.
Sarah concentrated on her breathing for a while. She finally managed to ask,
When did this happen?
Before you and Tessie were born. Sarah swallowed past the lump in her throat.
What happened?
What's that? Sarah slipped a sock on. It was like pulling teeth getting the story from her mother. She prompted,
To change your mind. What made you want to stay with Daddy?
Oh, about a million things, Kathy answered, a sly smile at her lips. I think I just got a little distracted by this other man, and I didn't realize how important your father was to me.
She sighed heavily.
I remember waking up one morning in my old room at Mama's, and all I could think was that Eddie should have been there with me. I wanted him so badly.
Kathy frowned at Sarah's reaction to this.
Don't go getting your color up. There are other ways to want someone.
Sarah cringed at the scolding, slipping on her other sock.
So you called him up?
I went over to the house, and I sat on the front porch and practically begged him to take me back.
No, on second thought, I did beg. I told him that if we were both going to be miserable without each other, we might as well be miserable together, and that I was so sorry and I'd never take him for granted again, as long as I lived.
Take him for granted?
Kathy put her hand on Sarah's arm.
That's the part that hurts, isn't it?
The part where you feel like you don't matter to him as much as you used to.
Sarah nodded, trying to remember to breathe.
Her mother had hit the nail on the head.
She prompted,
What did Daddy do when you said this?
Told me to get up off the porch and come in for some breakfast.
Kathy put her hand to her chest, patting it.
I don't know how Eddie found it in his heart to forgive me. He's such a proud man. But I'm thankful he did. It made me love him even more to know that he could forgive me for something so horrible like that. That I could hurt him to the core, and he could still love me.
I think starting out like that made the marriage stronger.
The smile intensified.
Of course, then, I did have a secret weapon.
What's that?
You.
Me?
Kathy stroked Sarah's cheek.
I was seeing your father again, but it was so strained. Nothing was like it was before. Then I got pregnant with you. and life just took over. I think having you between us made your father see the big picture. Next thing, Tessie was here. Then you were both in school. Then you were both grown and off to college. She smiled. It just takes time. Love and time. And having a little red-headed hellion to chase after is a good distraction. Well, I'm not going to get pregnant, Sarah countered, conscious of the edge to her tone. Kathy seemed to think out her answer. Sometimes it takes thinking you've lost something to realize the real value of it, she said. Don't tell Tessie. Sarah nodded her agreement. She stood, tucking her T-shirt into her pants. I told him, Mama, she said. I left the transcript for him. Kathy asked, the trial transcript? Yeah, Sarah said, leaning against the chest of drawers. I know he's read it. I left it in the bathroom for him. And? And, Sarah said, he hasn't even called. He hasn't said anything to me all day. Well, Kathy said, her mind obviously made up. Fuck him, then. He's trash. Chapter 22. Jeffrey found 633 Ashton Street easily enough. The house was dilapidated, no more than a square made of cinder blocks. The windows seemed to be an afterthought, none of them the same size. A ceramic fireplace was on the front porch, stacks of papers and magazines piled to the side of it, probably to use for kindling. He took a look around the house, trying to act casually. Wearing a suit and tie, driving the white town car, it wasn't like Jeffrey fit in with the surroundings. Ashton Street, at least the part Jack Wright lived on, was run down and seedy. Most of the houses in the vicinity were boarded up, yellow posters warning they were condemned. Kids played in the packed dirt yards of these houses, their parents nowhere to be seen. There was a smell to the place, not exactly sewage, but something in that same family. Jeffrey was reminded of driving past the city dump on the outskirts of Madison. On a good day, even when you were downwind, the smell of decomposing trash still reached your nose, even with the windows up and the air on. Jeffrey took a few breaths, trying to get used to the smell as he approached the house. The door had a heavy mesh screen over it with a padlock securing it to the frame. The actual door had three deadbolts and one lock that looked like it required a puzzle piece to open it rather than a key. Jack Wright had been in prison a great deal of his life. This was obviously a man who wanted his privacy. Jeffrey took a look around before walking over to one of the windows. It, too, had a wire mesh and a heavy lock, but the casing was old and easily broken. A couple of firm pushes dislodged the entire frame. Jeffrey glanced around before removing the window, casing and all, and slipping into the house. The living room was dark and dingy, with trash and papers stacked around the room. There was an orange couch on the floor with dark stains dripping down. Jeffrey could not tell if it was from tobacco juice or some kind of body fluid. What he did know was an overpowering odor of sweat mixed with Lysol permeated the room. Edging the top of the living room walls, like a decorative border, were all kinds of crucifixes. They varied in size from something you would get out of a candy vending machine to some that were at least 10 inches long. They were nailed into the wall, edge to edge, tied up against one another in one continuous band. Continuing the Jesus theme, posters on the wall that looked like they had been taken from a Sunday school room showed Jesus and the disciples. In one, he was holding a lamb. In another, he was holding out his hands, showing the wounds in his palms. Jeffrey felt his heart rate quicken at the sight of this. He reached to his gun, taking the strap off his holster as he walked toward the front of the house to make sure no one was coming up the drive. In the kitchen,
Plates were stacked in the sink, crusted and foul-looking. The floor was sticky, and the whole room felt wet from something other than water. The bedroom was the same way, a musky odor clinging like a wet wash rag against Jeffrey's face. On the wall over the stained mattress was a large poster of Jesus Christ, a halo behind his head. Like the poster in the living room, Jesus held his palms out to show the wounds on his hands. The crucifixion motif continued around the periphery of the bedroom. But these were larger crosses. Standing on the bed, Jeffrey could see that someone, probably Wright, had used red paint to exaggerate Jesus' wounds, dripping the blood down the torso, enhancing the crown of thorns resting on his head. Black X's were across the eyes on every Jesus Jeffrey could see. It was as if Wright had wanted to stop his eyes from watching him. What Wright was doing that he felt needed to be hidden was the question Jeffrey needed to answer. Jeffrey stepped off the bed. He looked through some of the magazines, taking the time to put on a pair of latex gloves from his pocket before touching anything. The magazines were mostly older editions of People and Life. The bedroom closet was stacked floor to ceiling with pornography. Busty babes sat beside righteous redheads. Jeffrey thought of Sarah, and a lump came to his throat. Using his foot, Jeffrey kicked the mattress up. A Sig Sauer 9mm was resting on the box spring. The weapon looked new and well cared for. In a neighborhood like this one, only an idiot would go to sleep without a gun handy. Jeffrey smiled as he pushed the mattress back. This could help him out later on. Opening the dresser, Jeffrey did not know what he expected to find. More porn, maybe. Another gun, or some kind of makeshift weapon. Instead, the top two drawers were filled with women's underwear. Not just underwear, the silky, sexy kind that Jeffrey liked to see Sarah in. There were teddies and thongs, French-cut panties with bows at the hips, and they were all extremely large. Large enough to fit a man. Jeffrey resisted the urge to shudder. He took out a pen to go through the contents of the drawers, not wanting to get stuck with a needle or anything sharp, not wanting to get a venereal disease. Jeffrey was about to close one of the drawers when something changed his mind. He was missing something. Moving aside a pair of dark green lace panties, he saw what he was looking for. The newspaper lining the bottom of the drawers was from the special Sunday section of the Grant County Observer. He had recognized the masthead. Pushing aside the clothes, Jeffrey took out the sheet of newspaper. The front page showed a slow news day. A picture of the mayor holding a pig in his arms beamed back at Jeffrey. The date put the paper at more than a year old. He opened the other drawers, looking for more observers. He found a few, but most of them carried innocuous stories. Jeffrey found it interesting that Jack Wright subscribed to the Grant County Observer. He went back into the living room, checking out the stacks of papers on the floor with renewed interest. Brenda Collins, one of Wright's other victims after Sarah, had been from Tennessee, Jeffrey remembered. A copy of The Monthly Vols, a newsletter for the University of Tennessee graduates, was tucked in with some newspapers from Alexander City, Alabama. In the next stack, Jeffrey found more out-of-state papers, all from small towns. Beside these were postcards, all from Atlanta, all showing different scenes around town. The backs were blank, waiting to be filled in. Jeffrey could not imagine what a man like Wright would be doing with the postcards. He did not strike Jeffrey as the type of person to have friends. Jeffrey turned around, making sure he had not missed anything in the cramped room. There was a television set tucked into the old fireplace. It looked fairly new, the kind you could buy on the street for $50 if you did not ask too many questions about where it had come from. On top of the set was a cable converter box. He walked back toward the front window to leave, but stopped when he saw something under the couch. He used his foot to tilt the couch over, sending cockroaches scurrying across the floor. A small black keyboard was on the floor. The converter box was actually a receiver for the keyboard. Jeffrey turned the set on, pressing the buttons on the keyboard until the receiver logged on to the internet. He sat on the edge of the upturned couch as he waited for the system to make a connection. At the station, Brad Stevens was the computer person, but Jeffrey had learned enough from watching the young patrolman to know how to navigate his way around. Wright's email was easy enough to access. Aside from an offer from a Chevy parts dealership and the requisite hot young teens looking for college money, the kind of email that everyone in the world got, there was a long letter from a woman who appeared to be Wright's mother. Another email had a photo attachment of a young woman posed with her legs wide open. The sender's email address was a series of random numbers. Probably, he was a prison buddy of Wright's. Still, Jeffrey wrote down the address on a scrap piece of paper he had in his pocket. Using the arrow keys, Jeffrey went to the bookmark section. In addition to various porn and violence sites, Jeffrey found a link for the Grant Observer online. He could not have been more shocked. There, on the television screen, was today's front page announcing the suicide of Julia Matthews last night. Jeffrey punched the down arrow, skimming the article again. He went into the archives and performed a search for Sybil Adams. Seconds later, an article on Career Day from last year came on screen. A search for Julia Matthews brought up today's front page, but nothing else. Over 60 articles came up when he typed in Sarah's name. Jeffrey logged off and turned the couch right side up. Outside, he pressed the window back into the hole he had made. It did not want to stay, so he was forced to drag one of the chairs over to prop it in. From his car, it didn't look like the window had been tampered with, but Jack Wright would know as soon as he walked on his front porch that someone had been in his house. As security-conscious as the man seemed to be, this would probably be a good way to push his buttons. The streetlight over Jeffrey's car came on as he got in. Even on this hellhole of a street, the sunset dipping into the Atlanta skyline was something to behold. Jeffrey imagined but for the sun setting and rising, the people on this block wouldn't feel human. He waited for 3.5 hours before the blue Chevy Nova pulled into the driveway. The car was old and dirty, flakes of rust showing through the trunk and taillights. Wright had obviously tried to make a few repairs. Silver duct tape crisscrossed the tail end, and on one side of the bumper was a decal that said, "God is my co-pilot." On the other side was a zebra-striped sticker that said, "I'm going wild at the Atlanta Zoo." Jack Wright had been in the system long enough to know what a cop looks like. He gave Jeffrey a wary glance as he stepped out of the Nova. Wright was a pudgy man with a receding hairline. His shirt was off, and Jeffrey could see he had what could only be described as breasts. Jeffrey guessed this was from the depot. One of the main reasons rapists and pedophiles tended to go off the drug was the nasty side effects that caused some of them to put on weight and take on womanly attributes. Wright nodded to Jeffrey as Jeffrey made his way up the driveway. As neglected as this area of town was, all the streetlights were in working order. The house was lit like it was broad daylight. When Wright spoke, his voice was high-pitched, another side effect of the depot. He asked, "You looking for me?"
"That's right,"
Jeffrey answered, stopping in front of the man who had raped and stabbed Sarah Linton.
"Well, damn,"
Wright said, pursing his lips.
"I guess some girl done got snatched up, huh? Y'all always come knocking on my door when some young thing goes missing."
"Let's go into the house," Jeffrey said.
"I don't think so,"
Wright countered, leaning back against the car.
"She a pretty girl? The one missing?"
He paused as if he expected an answer. He licked his tongue slowly along his lips.
"I only pick the pretty ones."
"It's an older case," Jeffrey said, trying not to let himself get baited.
Amy? Is it my sweet little Amy?
Jeffrey stared. He recognized the name from the case file. Amy Baxter had taken her life after being raped by Jack Wright. She was a nurse who had moved to Atlanta from Alexander City.
No, not Amy, Wright said,
putting his hand to his chin as if in thought.
Was it that sweet little...
He stopped himself, looking over at Jeffrey's car.
Grant County, huh? Why didn't you say so?
He smiled, showing one of his chipped front teeth.
How's my little Sarah doing?
Jeffrey took a step toward the man, but Wright did not take the intimidation. Wright said,
Go on and hit me. I like it rough.
Jeffrey stepped back, willing himself not to punch the man. Suddenly, Wright scooped his breasts into his hands.
You like these, Daddy?
He smiled at the look of disgust that must have been on Jeffrey's face.
I take the depot. But you know that already, don't you, honey? You know what it does to me, too, don't you?
He lowered his voice.
Makes me like a girl.
Gives the boys the best of both worlds.
Stop it, Jeffrey said, glancing around.
Wright's neighbors had come out to see the show.
I got balls the size of marbles, Wright said, putting his hands to the waist of his blue jeans. You want to see them?
Jeffrey lowered his voice to a grumble.
Not unless you want to take the word chemical out of your castration.
Wright chuckled.
You're a big, strong man, you know that?
He asked.
You supposed to be taking care of my Sarah.
Jeffrey could do nothing but swallow.
They all want to know why I picked him. Why me? Why me?
He trilled, his voice higher.
Her? I wanted to see was she a real redhead.
Jeffrey stood there, unable to move.
I guess you know she is, huh? I can tell by the looking in your eyes.
Wright crossed his arms over his chest, his eyes on Jeffrey's.
Now she's got some great tits. I loved sucking them.
He licked his lips.
I wish you could have seen the fear on her face. I could tell she wasn't used to it. Hadn't had herself a real man yet, know what I mean?
Jeffrey put his hand around the man's neck, backing him into the car. The action was so fast, Jeffrey wasn't even sure what he was doing until he felt Jack Wright's long fingernails digging into the skin on the back of his hand. Jeffrey forced himself to take his hand away. Wright sputtered, coughing, trying to catch his breath. Jeffrey walked a tight circle, checking on the neighbors. None of them had moved. They all seemed entranced by the show.
You think you can scare me?
Wright said, his voice raspy.
I had bigger than you, two at a time in prison.
Where were you last Monday? Jeffrey asked.
I was at work, brother. Check with my P.O.
Maybe I will.
She made a spot check on me around,
Wright pretended to think this through.
I'd say around 2:30. That the time you looking for?
Jeffrey did not answer. Sybil Adams' time of death had been printed in the Observer.
I was sweeping and mopping and taking out the trash,
Wright continued.
Jeffrey indicated the tattoo.
I see you're a religious man.
Wright looked at his arm.
That's what caught me up with Sarah.
You like to keep up with your girls, huh?
Jeffrey asked.
Maybe look through the newspapers? Maybe keep up with them on the internet?
Wright looked nervous for the first time.
You been in my house?
I like what you did with the walls, he said. All those little Jesuses. Their eyes just follow you when you walk around the room.
Wright's face changed. He showed Jeffrey the side that only a handful of unfortunate women had ever seen as he screamed,
That is my personal property! You don't belong in there!
I was in there, Jeffrey said, able to be calm now that Wright was not. I went through everything.
You bastard!
Wright yelled, throwing a punch. Jeffrey sidestepped, twisting the man's arm behind him. Wright pitched forward, falling face first into the ground. Jeffrey was on top of him, his knee pressed into the man's back. What do you know? Jeffrey demanded.
Let me go,
Wright begged. Please let me go. Jeffrey took out his handcuffs and forced Wright into them. The clicking sound of the locks sent the man into hyperventilation.
I just read about it,
Wright said.
Please, please let me go.
Jeffrey leaned down, whispering in the man's ear. You're going back to jail.
Don't send me back,
Wright begged.
Please.
Jeffrey reached down, tugging the ankle bracelet. Knowing how the city of Atlanta worked, this would be faster than dialing 911. When the bracelet would not budge, Jeffrey used the heel of his shoe to bust it.
You can't do that!
Wright screamed.
You can't do that! They saw you!
Jeffrey looked up, remembering the neighbors. He watched, wordlessly, as they all turned their backs, disappearing into their houses.
Oh, God, please don't send me back,
Wright begged.
Please, I'll do anything.
They're not going to like that 9 mil under your mattress either, Jack.
Oh, God.
The man sobbed, shaking. Jeffrey leaned against the Nova, taking out the business card Keith had given him earlier. The name on the card was Marianne Moon. Jeffrey glanced at his watch. At 10 till 8 on a Friday night, he doubted very seriously that she would be happy to see him. Chapter 23. Lena closed her eyes as the sun beat down on her face. The water was warm and inviting, a slight breeze crossing her body as each wave gently rolled under her. She could not remember the last time she had been to the ocean, but the vacation was well earned, to say the least.
Look, Sybil said, pointing above them.
Lena followed her sister's finger, spotting a seagull in the ocean sky. She found herself concentrating on the clouds instead. They looked like cotton balls against a baby blue backdrop.
Did you want this back?
Sybil asked, handing Lena a red kickboard. Lena laughed.
Hank told me you lost it.
Sybil smiled.
I put it where he couldn't see it.
With sudden clarity, Lena realized it was Hank and not Sybil who had been blinded. She could not understand how she had gotten the two confused, but there was Hank on the beach, dark glasses covering his eyes. He sat back, propped up on his hands, letting the sun hit him square on the chest. He looked more tan than Lena had ever seen him. As a matter of fact, all the times they had gone to the beach before, Hank had stayed in the hotel room instead of going out on the beach with the girls. What he did in there all day, Lena did not know. Sometimes Sybil would join him to take some time out from the sun. But Lena loved being on the beach. She loved playing in the water or looking for impromptu volleyball games she could flirt her way into. That was how Lena had met Greg Mitchell, her last boyfriend of any consequence. Greg was playing volleyball with a group of his friends. He was about 28 years old, but his friends were much younger and more interested in looking at girls than actually playing the game. Lena had walked over, knowing she was being sized up, rated like a side of meat by the young men, and asked to join the game. Greg had thrown the ball at her straight from his chest, and Lena had caught it the same way. After a while, the younger men trailed off in search of alcohol or women, or both. Lena and Greg played for what seemed like hours. If he had been expecting Lena to throw the games in honor of his masculinity, he had another think coming. She had beaten him so badly that, by the end of the third game, he had forfeited, offering to buy her dinner as her prize. He took her to some cheap